Bienvenue à Legalese, une émission consacrée au droit qui vise à en rendre le jargon plus accessible tout en évaluant de manière critique ces institutions. Welcome to Legalese, a broadcast about lawcast broadly. Je suis Audrey, puis je vais être votre hôte pour cet épisode de Legalese. Ça fait que ce mois-ci, ce dont on va jaser, c'est de la crise du logement. On va essayer de la décortiquer, de se rappeler c'est quoi nos droits, de se rappeler aussi la manière dont ça interfère avec tellement de droits, notamment celui de quitter un milieu de vie qui est violent. So, to kick it off, Legalese Brett chatted with Cecilia Mahongon, where she got to speak over work at Hojo, which is the Concordia-based Housing and Jobs Research Center. So, Hojo primarily serves students, but is open to the wider Montreal community, helping empower people by communicating tenancy law in an accessible manner. Cecilia notes the short supply of affordable housing in Montreal despite pandemic-related vacancies and what to do if your landlord hits you with a rent hike, among other things.
I'm Cecilia Mahongon. I'm an ex-international student from Italy, and I work at the Hojo, the CSU of Campus Housing and Job Research Center, since October 2018. What we do basically is empowering all the Concordia community, let's say, in the meaning of students and non-students that have access to our services to learn about their housing rights, their job rights.
So it's not just for students, there's non-students?
No, we are open to everyone in Montreal. We are Concordia based, so of course we are there primarily for Concordia students. When we used to, you know, pre-pandemic, we used to have an office both at the downtown campus, at the Loyola campus. So students could just, you know, walk inside the office whenever they had some free time. But we also help whoever in Montreal that needs help with housing rights. Nobody pays. It's free. Access is for all. We speak both English and French, but there's more demand on the Anglophone side because in Montreal, there are a lot of really well-working housing committees in every neighborhood, but most of them are Francophones. So we are there also for all that part of the population that it's more at ease with the English language.
And so could you talk a bit more about some of the specific things that that Hojo does?
Well, we are available just like remotely, so through our emails and phone. We can answer whatever question related to housing rights. Let's say, big example, because it's March, rent renewal and rent increases. Your landlord sends you a rent increase, you don't know what to do, basically. You never received one, maybe you're not from Quebec, so how do you behave in this situation? We explain to you what the law says, so what your rights are, what you can do, legally speaking, what your landlord can do, legally speaking, and how this process would work. So we don't give legal advice, but we do give legal information, which is what you actually need to feel empowered. Explained also in a way that makes more sense, because, you know, legalese terms for people that do not specialize either in law or these kind of topics might have some difficulties in cracking exactly the code. So what we do is trying to make it like accessible to everyone. We also have some workshops available just online at the moment, of course, but we used to give them in person, explaining, for example, again, generally speaking, housing rights, starting from the really basic things like even the size of the apartments in Quebec, like what does it mean a 4.5, what's a 5.5, this kind of stuff. It's not that obvious for everyone. So, you know, there's also this kind of really basic information, but also like, you should never give up your social insurance number for any reason. Or in Quebec, there are just one kind of deposit that is allowed, which is first month rent. You cannot pay or you cannot be asked to pay other deposits, for example. This kind of sometimes basic but really important information that you need to have as a tenant whether it's your first experience renting or you're more experienced with it, sometimes you can have a situation in which you're not sure about how to behave and so until what extent your rights go. So that's where we come into the play.
I'm curious, what sort of general trends in the last year have you seen? I mean, the word generally is that it's harder and harder to find affordable housing in Montreal. Is that something that you have seen?
Yeah, in the meaning of, let's say, in different ways. From 2018 until the pandemic, it has been a continuous trend, like increasing the demand for housing and decreasing the offer of affordable housing. We're talking about, of course, central neighborhoods, but also other neighborhoods that are getting more gentrified, we can say. So that it's this has been a thing. Right now with the pandemic, there's the weird situation in which the offer of apartments is actually increasing, especially in areas like downtown. If I remember correctly, the vacancy rate in downtown right now is around 6%. So it's crazy compared with just 1 year ago. But in any case, it's not that affordable for many people. So because we need to consider the pandemic, so a lot of people lost their job but cannot work because of COVID. And this doesn't help in the same way, of course. So there's surely a trend still in the need of affordable housing, yes, from many sectors of the society, not only students, but you know, we mainly work with students, so we see that side the most. So surely for students, there's an high demand of housing that is actually affordable, but also other sections are suffering in this sense.
And so is there particularly like noticeable trends? I mean, so you've mentioned downtown. I'm curious about other neighborhoods. Is there things that are really significant from what you've seen?
Well, generally speaking, Plateau Mont-Royal used to be also a pretty expensive area, especially in certain parts of the neighborhood itself. Matching together with older buildings with more issues that need to be fixed and a tendency of sometimes bed bugs infestation, generally speaking. So that it's a thing. Mile Hand, Park X also, there's been an influx that we have been seeing lately, especially with the project and the new campus of Université de Montréal that has, of course, influenced somehow the value of apartments in that area. How can we say it's kind of a wave that starts from a center and then spreads. So that's basically also gentrification, you know, like that's how it works. It starts from one point and keeps extending. That's a trend that we have been seeing, but on the other side, many people realize that they didn't want to live in a little condo downtown, that they wanted, you know, a house somewhere outside with a yard, a space, way more space than you can have in a downtown or in any case in a condo or in an apartment. So many people are actually trying to buy houses outside Montreal, which explains the vacancy rate going up together with a lot of people that didn't move to Montreal given the situation. But again, we are still in that situation for which, yes, the apartments are available, but not everyone can afford them. And there's no movement to actually have those rents frozen for sometimes or this kind of stuff.
Great. So thanks for that. I saw recently on a Facebook page for it, Verdun contre la gentrification, screen caps of messages between a prospective tenant and the landlord, and the rent was kind of going up in real time as applications sort of poured in, I think, for this apartment. They said, well, hey, there's 100 people want this place, so this is, you know, the new rent. I'm just curious, I mean, I know that's illegal, but is there anything that tenants can do against these sorts of...
So if you discover that the previous tenant used to pay a way cheaper rent than you actually do right now, you have a certain timeline to apply to the Tribunal Administratif du Logement, the administrative tribunal for housing, and ask a commissioner to review the situation and have the rent put to the real value, let's say. So not super increased out of the blue, let's say. It has to be justified in any case. So there are recourses. Unfortunately, it's something that you can do like just after you sign the lease. But, you know, that's the kind of protection that you get when you have a lease. The moment in which you have a legal contract with a landlord, the law in Quebec assumes that your relationship as a tenant with the landlord is going to be in good faith on both sides. That's right. The main thing. It's not, you know, it's not ideal in the best of the world possible. There would be another way to get things always in the right and in the respect of everybody's rights and the law. But unfortunately, it's not like that. So there are recourses of things that can be done after.
So I guess while we're on the subject of the rent increases in March, I know, you know, I think when you break it down, there's a fairly complex formula involving municipal taxes. But is there kind of a general guide that you can give people of what might be a reasonable increase or what maybe isn't and they should be alarmed and look a little closer at?
So it's not super friendly, the process of understanding rental increase calculation, that's for sure, but it's not impossible. In the meaning that every year, what used to be the Régie and now is the TAL, releases a calculation tool. The English version is just in PDF. The French version, it's also automatic on the website. So you input the numbers and the calculation is done automatically by the software. What you will need to generally consider when you receive a rent increase is, municipal and school taxes. It's something you can actually Google for your neighborhood and trying to understand how much did they go up and down. There were any major works that actually improved the quality of the building and your quality of life as a tenant in that unit and in that building. That it's something to consider. The calculation tool from the TAL, for example, always includes the percentages of inflation, so increase or decrease of whatever costs like energy and this kind of stuff, so that it's useful for the calculation. And again, going back to the good faith, as a tenant, generally speaking, tenants have the right to refuse the rent increase in open negotiation with their landlord. Okay, landlord, I'm not too sure about this rental increase, so can we actually see the number? Can we talk about it using the official calculations tool? So if there's good faith on both sides, the landlord would be, in any case, available to explain you the numbers and showing you how did he or she come up with such a rent increase. Negotiation is always a tool available to tenants. So that's always something you don't need to just say no, end of the conversation, I'll see you at the TAL. There are options for a conversation and mediation. And if things really go south, there's the TAL for what will happen is, again, the calculation. Mathematical calculation performed by the commissioner following the same principles and requests as on the calculation tool that they release. For which a landlord should show proper invoices. So if something is missing, like the landlord is claiming major works and he doesn't have an invoice for that, it cannot be just accepted. There must be discussion. There must be a commissioner investigating the thing because, you cannot just charge something without any proof. So that's more or less the scenario of rental increase.
Thanks. So I guess we've talked quite a bit about what, individual tenants can try to do. Would you have any suggestions for tenants as a group? Yeah, or just people concerned with tenants' rights more broadly?
I would suggest every tenant, whether all together or individually, to just get as much information about their rights as they can. For the simple reason that once you are empowered and you know your rights, you can help other people empowering themselves. We have been seeing cases of tenants, putting themselves together for fighting something that wasn't going in wasn't right towards them from the landlord. And it's always amazing to see tenants just getting together and knowing their rights and going together towards something. To have rights respected, that's always a powerful moment for everyone. So exercise your rights, like learn your rights, inform yourselves, and then exercise them. You don't have to just accept whatever. There's the law, you have rights, there are recourses, just don't give up because it would just be easier. You know, once you give up a little bit of your rights, it's just a path that keeps going.
Great, I think that's a wonderful conclusion. So I'll leave it at that. But yeah, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
So that was Fabulous Brett and Fabulous Cecilia. Au Québec, 8 femmes ont été tuées par leur conjoint ou ex-conjoint depuis le début de l'année. Donc la violence post-séparation, elle n'est pas prise au sérieux, d'après les intervenantes qui soutiennent les survivantes et pas mal tout le monde qui a du bon sens. Donc souvent, le plus grand obstacle pour les femmes, c'est le manque d'hébergement pour elles et leurs enfants. Donc l'Alliance provinciale des maisons d'hébergement de deuxième étape pour femmes et enfants victimes de violences conjugales offre les services spécialisés par l'entremise de logements transitoires sécuritaires. Donc Gaëlle Fédida, c'est la coordonnatrice de l'Alliance et elle a parlé avec Michelle de Legalese au début du mois de mars.
Donc bonjour, je suis Gaëlle Fédida, la coordonnatrice des dossiers politiques de l'Alliance des maisons d'hébergement de deuxième étape pour femmes et enfants victimes de violences conjugales. Au Québec, on a 26 maisons membres réparties un petit peu partout, malheureusement pas partout, parce que malheureusement, il existe encore 5 régions sans service de maisons de deuxième étape. Et donc, les maisons de deuxième étape visent la prévention de l'homicide conjugal. Ce sont des appartements sécurisés pour les 8% de femmes qui sortent des refuges d'urgence et qui ont encore des besoins de sécurité majeurs à cause de la dangerosité de l'ex-conjoint. Donc, c'est vraiment après la maison d'urgence de première étape que les femmes où il y a encore de la dangerosité importante et donc un risque d'homicide conjugal sont référées dans une maison de deuxième étape.
Et donc, votre organisation a demandé, je pense, il y a plus d'un an que le gouvernement a promis des unités d'hébergement. Est-ce qu'à date, on a des nouvelles sur ces maisons de deuxième étape?
Malheureusement, non. Donc, le gouvernement, en août 2018, a sorti son plan d'action en violence conjugale qui reconnaissait pour la première fois les services de deuxième étape et le besoin de développer le réseau. Donc, ça, c'est une intention politique et une annonce qui date de août 2018. À partir du printemps 2019, les maisons ont commencé à déposer des projets. Et puis, donc, ça fait plus d'un an et demi maintenant qu'on est en attente de réponse sur ces projets-là. Donc, on les attend avec impatience dans le prochain budget qui devrait être déposé dans le mois qui vient. C'est pour nous une urgence, vu qu'on a des taux de refus qui sont complètement inacceptables pour des femmes qui sont à risque d'homicide conjugal. Et on voit bien en ce moment, justement, qu'avec la pandémie, la question de la violence conjugale ne s'est pas résorbée, tout au contraire. Et on vient de vivre 5 féminicides qui sont exactement des homicides conjugaux dus à la violence post-séparation. Et c'est effectivement des services spécialisés que nous, on offre dans les maisons de deuxième étape. Donc, c'est clair que là, on attend encore la réponse pour 106 nouvelles unités qu'on espère trouver dans le budget. Puis, ce sont encore une fois des unités déposées depuis plus d'un an et demi. Le problème, là, c'est vraiment d'avoir une perspective de développement à moyen terme. Parce que dans l'état actuel de la capacité de service, on déborde. On déborde et on a très peur de la fin du confinement parce que ben on a peur, tant mieux parce que les femmes vont pouvoir sortir, mais il va falloir qu'on puisse les accueillir. Et ça va être difficile. On a bien vu l'année dernière quand le confinement s'est détendu au printemps là, les demandes d'hébergement se sont remises à exploser. Et bon, ça c'est pas du tout un problème qui date de la pandémie, ça date d'avant la pandémie, le fait qu'il y avait pas assez de place en violence conjugale. Mais c'est sûr que là, avec la pandémie, ça exacerbe d'autant plus ce problème de manque de place.
Et donc, c'est quoi la capacité quand on parle de ça déborde, on parle de combien de femmes?
Actuellement, sur les deuxièmes étapes, on estime qu'on est à peu près la moitié de la capacité par rapport aux besoins. Donc, avec les nouvelles unités qu'on a demandées, ben, ça améliorerait beaucoup, beaucoup la situation. Mais on n'arriverait toujours pas à combler les besoins. C'est qu'il nous manque aussi des groupes de femmes qui veulent aller de l'avant parce que c'est extrêmement complexe et hasardeux de se lancer dans un projet comme ça, surtout quand on voit que le soutien gouvernemental n'est pas au rendez-vous. Alors malheureusement, dans les régions où il n'y a pas de service actuellement, on a certains projets qui sont déposés, Mais on a notamment en Abitibi-Témiscamingue, il n'y a pas de projet de déposé. Y a eu, moi j'ai déjà été contactée par un groupe de femmes d'Abitibi qui souhaitaient développer une maison de deuxième étape, mais qui ont laissé tomber parce que c'est beaucoup trop de complexe. Donc elles ne se sentaient pas les reins pour pouvoir le faire. Maintenant, c'est sûr que si effectivement le gouvernement fait un suivi de ces annonces politiques qui datent donc déjà, maintenant on est dans la troisième année du plan d'action, il faudrait quand même que ça débloque là.
Et vous avez dit c'est vraiment des groupes de femmes, donc c'est vraiment des projets de grassroots qu'on voit pour ces maisons-là, parce que
Tout à fait, ce sont des groupes communautaires issus de la communauté. Ce sont les premières maisons d'hébergement au Québec, ça date d'il y a une quarantaine d'années. Ce sont des groupes de femmes qui se sont mobilisées contre la violence conjugale. Et petit à petit, ces réseaux-là se sont développés donc, pour ouvrir des maisons d'urgence, puis depuis une quinzaine, vingtaine d'années, des maisons de deuxième étape, pour vraiment la mise en sécurité des femmes qui sont le plus en danger. Ça vient des groupes de femmes du terrain, ça. Donc, oui, tout à fait. Ce sont des groupes communautaires, comme on en connaît beaucoup, comme tout le communautaire, soutenu par des femmes et pour des femmes qui soutiennent le pays à bout de bras et les services sociaux principalement à bout de bras.
Et si on regarde le système juridique, parler d'un droit au logement.
On est tout à fait dans le mouvement des revendications pour du logement social et pour deux raisons. La première raison, c'est que les maisons de deuxième étape se montent dans des logements sociaux. On a des conventions d'exploitation avec la SHQ, donc la Société d'habitation du Québec ou l'instance fédérale, dépendamment qui finance. Puis là, je voudrais dire quand même, c'est une responsabilité gouvernementale de financer le logement social. Donc, et dans le logement social, il est prévu dans la loi que, il y ait des maisons d'hébergement pour femmes qui sont montées sur le logement social. Donc, il nous en faut pour les maisons de femmes. Mais deuxièmement, il en faut aussi pour les femmes quand elles sortent des refuges, des maisons d'hébergement. Parce que quand elles sortent de chez nous, là, ici à Montréal, ben beaucoup de femmes, malheureusement, à cause de la violence conjugale, ont pu perdre leur emploi, donc se retrouvent sur l'assistance sociale. Et ce n'est pas avec des allocations comme ça qu'on est capable de se loger, par exemple, à Montréal. Donc effectivement, il y a vraiment des enjeux dans la durée pour pouvoir continuer à soutenir ces femmes, y compris en logement social. Donc notre demande, elle est double et on contribue, tout le mouvement des maisons d'hébergement est un des acteurs des demandes de logement social. L'Alliance a fait une conférence de presse avec le FRAPRU il y a 10 jours pour demander des logements sociaux dans le prochain budget, exactement. On a aussi beaucoup contribué à l'époque, il y a quelques années, à la définition de la stratégie nationale logement fédérale. On a participé à ces travaux-là. En lien avec notre mission. Oui.
Et aussi, quand on parle de la violence conjugale, on voit des changements par exemple, dans la loi sur le divorce, le gouvernement québécois a parlé souvent de créer comme un nouveau tribunal. C'est quoi vos pensées sur cela?
Il ne faudrait pas qu'en parler, il faudrait le faire. Là, il y en a des recommandations. On a 193 recommandations d'experts qui ont été déposées juste avant Noël pour la réforme du système de la justice qui soit plus favorable aux victimes et surtout d'assurer une sécurité comment dire, un accompagnement beaucoup plus adéquat des victimes dans le système judiciaire. Et ça passe notamment par cette recommandation d'avoir un tribunal unifié de la famille, où les instances judiciaires différentes, c'est-à-dire criminelles et civiles et en droit de la jeunesse, seraient concomitantes, parce qu'elles le sont dans la vie des femmes, mais malheureusement, elles ne le sont pas dans le système juridique. Et aujourd'hui, dans le système juridique, le criminel ne parle pas au civil. Donc ça nous amène dans des situations pour les femmes et certains enfants, dans des situations de danger carrément. Parce que des avocats vont recommander à madame de ne pas parler de la violence conjugale pour ne pas compliquer les choses au niveau de la garde des enfants. Donc ça, c'est quelque chose d'inadmissible qui remet à nouveau la responsabilité sur la mère, alors que la mère elle-même est en danger et cherche à protéger ses enfants. Donc le tribunal unifié de la famille, ça fait des années que les groupes de femmes le demandent. Là, les experts le recommandent au gouvernement. Donc on attend d'être interpellé là pour assister au groupe de travail avec le ministère de la Justice. Ça fait déjà un mois qu'ils nous ont dit qu'ils allaient nous appeler. Ben, on attend. Alors, si vous voulez bien leur transmettre qu'on attend toujours leur appel, on est là, prête à travailler. Et on sait en plus que ce sont des solutions qui sont vraiment porteuses de changement parce que ce sont des choses qui sont implantées dans d'autres pays. Donc, il y a le tribunal unifié de la famille, mais il y a aussi le bracelet électronique, par exemple, le bracelet anti-rapprochement. On voit très bien que dans les crimes qui se sont commis au cours des 15 derniers jours, ben, le bracelet anti-rapprochement aurait eu toute sa légitimité là pour éviter ces meurtres-là. Malheureusement, le ministère de la Justice a décidé non pas d'aller de l'avant, mais de demander une étude de faisabilité. Alors, on se prend une autre année de retard sur ce projet-là, puisque le ministère de la Justice veut s'assurer que ça pourrait fonctionner au Québec. Encore une fois, ça fonctionne ailleurs, il n'y a pas de raison que ça ne fonctionne pas au Québec. On aurait à tout le moins pu faire commencer un programme pilote. Mais non, là pour l'instant, le gouvernement va étudier la faisabilité. On en est là, malheureusement.
Et juste pour terminer, c'est vraiment évident, mais c'est quoi le lien entre avoir accès à un logement et la sécurité ou la violence conjugale?
Ben, le lien, c'est qu'aujourd'hui, pour les femmes, pour une femme qui se retrouve coincée avec un conjoint violent, des enfants, une situation peut-être précaire au niveau financier, le fait de le contrôle coercitif qu'a exercé monsieur depuis plusieurs années l'a précarisé sur le plan financier, sur le plan de son autonomie professionnelle et financière, tout simplement. Donc, prendre la décision de quitter, en soi, ce n'est pas une décision facile. Mais après ça, quand se greffent dessus tous les enjeux purement logistiques, où est-ce que je vais aller avec mes enfants? Est-ce que je vais être en sécurité avec mes enfants? En plus, il y a la pandémie. Est-ce que j'amène mes enfants dans un endroit où ils risquent d'être infectés? Est-ce que monsieur va pouvoir me retrouver? Est-ce que je n'ai pas... Là, on me dit que c'est le couvre-feu à 20h. Je n'ai pas le droit de sortir de chez moi. Donc, on a fait des pressions pour que et M. Trudeau et M. Legault fassent des annonces au niveau de leur conférence de presse pour dire « Les femmes victimes de violences conjugales, vous n'êtes pas assujetties à tous les contrôles concernant les couvre-feux, les quarantaines, etc. Vous devez sortir de chez vous si vous êtes dans un milieu violent. » Mais encore une fois, ce sont des décisions très, très difficiles à prendre quand tu ne sais pas où tu t'en vas avec tes enfants. Puis un refuge d'urgence, ben un refuge d'urgence, c'est 3 mois maximum. Et souvent, les femmes ne savent pas qu'il peut y avoir d'autres options après le refuge d'urgence. Par exemple, une maison de deuxième étape quand tu es vraiment en danger. Donc, il faut informer les femmes qu'il y a des ressources pour elles de façon à ce qu'elles puissent sortir. Et une des ressources, une des façons de sortir, c'est d'être capable de s'assurer que tu vas pouvoir fermer la porte à clé sur toi à l'intérieur. Donc, c'est d'avoir ton logement indépendant et autonome. Alors, quand elle est en maison, elle va avoir une certaine assurance parce que c'est une maison, c'est une, comme une institution là, qui s'engage à sa sécurité, qui a des accords avec le poste de quartier, qui a des systèmes de sécurité installés dans la maison, etc. Mais à un moment donné, il va bien falloir qu'elle se retrouve chef de famille monoparentale dans son appartement, puis d'avoir repris le cours de sa vie. Puis là, si elle n'a pas accès à un logement abordable, ça va être très difficile. Beaucoup vont retourner au conjoint violent. Beaucoup vont malheureusement retomber dans des relations toxiques de par la précarité du logement. Donc, la précarité du logement, c'est un facteur de maintien de la femme avec son agresseur. Parce que le plus souvent, nous, 75% des femmes arrivent avec leurs enfants. On héberge beaucoup plus d'enfants que de femmes dans les maisons d'hébergement. Et donc, les femmes... elles vont penser à vouloir se sauver leur peau, mais probablement d'abord et avant tout avec leurs enfants. Et donc, si elles ne sont pas si elles ne se sentent pas sécurisées pour être capables de sécuriser leurs enfants, elles vont peut-être faire le calcul que ben, finalement, tant que ça tient, tant qu'il ne s'en prend pas aux enfants, qu'il ne s'en prend qu'à elles, ben, elle va pouvoir tenir encore, puis là, être capable au moins de leur donner un toit chauffé et à manger. C'est ça les dilemmes d'une femme qui se trouve dans cette situation. Donc oui, le logement social est une des voies de sortie pour les femmes. C'est une des voies de sortie de la violence, tout à fait.
Le budget provincial mentionné par Michel et Gaël pendant leur conversation a depuis été déposé. Fait que Québec a annoncé qu'il allait verser 4,5 millions par année pour rehausser les maisons d'hébergement de victimes de violences conjugales. Ce qui est largement insuffisant. Donc, le regroupement des femmes pour femmes victimes de violences conjugales s'est dit outré par la réponse du gouvernement. Donc, il a déclaré 4,5 millions par an supplémentaires représentent à peine 10 % des besoins que le regroupement réclame pour consolider le réseau des maisons d'aide et d'hébergement en violence conjugale. Fait que faites savoir à vos députés que vous n'êtes pas content ni contente. So finally, Legal is, again, Brett, sat down with Canadian housing policy researcher and consultant Steve Pomeroy to learn about the root causes of the affordable housing crisis and what might be done about it. They cover everything from the rise of housing commodification and speculative investment to rent control, inclusive zoning, and the impacts of Airbnb.
I've heard it expressed from a variety of sources that Canada is experiencing a housing crisis, but I guess before going further, I thought we should define what affordable means in this context. So I guess we're talking, you know, primarily about renters, but maybe not. So if you want to just elaborate on that subject.
Well, there's two very vexing phrases, you know, housing crisis and affordability. Check out the media and the international media, and you know, Australia is in a housing crisis, Europe's in a housing crisis, America's in a housing crisis. Everyone's got affordability issues. So I think it's, you know, it's been a constant state of belonging for, I mean, it seems to me, for the last 20 years, certainly since 2008, when things kind of collapsed a bit. But so yeah, so I think, you know, the term affordability, I think it's become a little ambiguous because it means all things to all people. For the folks who in the sort of the social justice poverty movements, you know, very deep low income rents are issues of affordability, and rent geared to income, social housing kind of stuff is how they frame affordability. The construction industry, the home builders, they see sort of entry level home ownership as being affordable. And if you look at the, you know, the papers of our national media these days, I mean, I think every day this week, Monday, Tuesday in the Globe and Mail, there have been articles on housing affordability, and well, it's a crisis, that kind of stuff. And there they're really talking about the fact that the, you know, house prices are just escalating so rapidly that it's leaving new buyers behind. So you have the very, you know, a multiple different conceptualizations of what affordability is. And it's all relative to which group you're talking to and where you're coming from.
Great. Well, I think that for our audience, probably focus on the low income folks who are, you know, sure. I guess that there's frustrations around new home ownership being, you know, unattainable in the way that it used to be. But those people, I suppose, still have options. If it's difficult right now to purchase a new home, how does that play into difficulties in finding rental accommodation?
One has to really understand and appreciate, you know, housing's a system, and things within systems, they reverberate on each other. So, you know, a few years ago when house prices were getting quite high and there was a lot of speculative buying going on, you know, the federal government and a number of provincial governments thought they should do something about this and tried to tamp down demand by basically changing the qualifying criteria to actually buy a house. What was called macroprudential policy, though, so you know, stress tests and those types of things. And what we saw happen was we did constrain the access to home ownership for first-time buyers. Because they were no longer moving into home ownership, they're staying in the rental market, demand remains strong in the rental market, and the folks that are staying there are the folks with better incomes who can almost buy a house, so they can afford to kind of pay better rents. So we sort of saw quite a significant increase in rents from 2015 to 2020, coincident with that constraint on access to home ownership. And then if the rents are going up in the rental market, of course, and vacancy rates are going down because the folks aren't moving out to become owners, you know, that's putting pressure on the low end rents and exacerbating affordability problems. So, in fact, if you wanted to address the affordability at the very bottom end of the market, getting more folks to leave the rental market and move into home ownership would actually have a positive knock-on effect downstream. So, you know, they are very much related. It's a very indirect effect and sort of a knock-on effect, but it does have an effect.
Okay, so that's kind of broad picture dynamics. Something on a sort of theoretical level or you know, that interests me, you know, and it plays into your initial comments about how the number of ways that a housing crisis or affordability is defined, an idea of like a fundamental tension between housing as a sort of a basic need or even a fundamental right, it's argued sometimes, you know, a place for shelter, privacy, intimacy, and, you know, domestic work, care work, and increasingly paid work too. And then on the other hand, is housing as a, you know, it seems like a real kind of primary vehicle for, you know, investment.
Yeah, it is real tension. And I think we've kind of evolved maybe, 20, 30 years ago, people, they considered, purchasing a house, they were purchasing a home. And I think what we've seen over the last 20, 30 years is really this sort of this shift to purchasing an investment. And we've really commodified housing to the point where even though folks are purchasing a home as a place to live in, the forefront in their mind is this is an investment. This is my nest egg for my retirement. There are a whole bunch of other attributes in terms of security of tenure and those types of things, which have some benefit for home ownership. But this notion that first and foremost, it's an investment versus just a home. And we see, Canada has quite a high rate of turnover amongst homeowners. I mean, countries like Germany, people buy a house once and they live it for the rest of their life. And they have a much more stable housing system than we do. Because we're constantly changing and wanting bigger, better, we move for various reasons. Sometimes, we change jobs and have to relocate accordingly. But quite often we just move just because we want, tired of this house, want something bigger, or the family's growing or declining, if the case may be. So we have this ongoing turnover kind of going on. And I think in that context, people will say, when you're sitting in a house and you kind of, you hear that the values are going up, but if you've been there for 20 years, you're not going anywhere, you don't really care. It's a paper gain. But when you're transacting all the time, you are much more aware of its value and the fact that it is an investment. I bought this house for $300,000 and now it's worth $1 million kind of thing. And people ignore the fact that they, if they sell it, they got to live somewhere. And basically just taking that $1 million and moving sideways. So I think we have very much more, it's in the psyche of consumers and homeowners that it is very much an investment, not just a home. And I think, the consequence of that ongoing sort of investment mentality, and that brings with it a lot of speculative purchase. Folks will start basically just flipping houses, especially in the current market where we're seeing, houses right here in Ottawa are going for $200,000 above asking. It's absurd. But that's the kind of context that really does draw in speculative buyers, because they can see, I can buy this year and flip it and make $100,000 next year.
Right. So does that process sort of encourage or maybe permit, those with more capital, I'm thinking like a kind of corporate landlord situation, but maybe in this case, kind of like corporate real estate speculation in general, whether it's like a separate divided homes or if it's apartment buildings and that kind of thing. Do you see like an increasing concentration of ownership in fewer hands to some extent? Or
alongside commodification is this sort of phenomenon that's been characterized in the sort of the literature as the financialization of housing. And before, people would buy a house or various investors would invest in building a rental property, and they would then operate it for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever, and generate revenues off the rents. What we've seen in the last couple of decades is the increasing involvement of large capital funds and real estate investment trusts purchasing these assets. And unlike an investor that's buying the building for their own portfolio and earning an income, when they're in these funds and you've got multiple shareholders in those funds, and the only reason they bought that fund is because they want to get yield on their investment, you're on this yield machine. And the funds are constantly motivated and required to generate yield for their shareholders. So they will employ various strategies to basically maximize the revenue off that particular asset. Unlike the more benevolent landlords, I guess, of the past. And so REITs, real estate investment trusts, which are one of the sort of specific types of capital funds, we had one or two in 1995. We've got over 40 now, and not all of them invest in residential. Some of them are commercial, some of them are industrial, but probably two-thirds of them do have properties in the residential area. And you can read the financial statements of these corporations. I was looking at one last week for CAPREIT, which is one of the biggest REITs in the country. And they were sort of, talking about, their strategies to generate yield for investors is to purchase underperforming assets, what you and I would call affordable housing. It's affordable in that, when we, this affordable term, the affordable housing sector, so public housing, social housing, which is sort of defined as affordable. But the reality is that in Canada, only 5% of our total housing stock is in the social housing sector, owned and operated by public or nonprofit organizations. So the vast majority of the lower rent stock is actually in the private market, owned and operated by private individuals and or private corporations and companies. And it's those kind of those holdings in the private market that these large capital funds have chased after. So you maybe have a family or a couple that bought a 20 unit walk-up apartment downtown Montreal 30 years ago. They're getting onto retirement. The kids don't want to take over the property management business. So the REITs kind of in a somewhat predatory way try to seek out those small holdings and try and purchase those properties. Depending where you are in the country, most provinces have a rent regulation system that controls rents for sitting tenants. But when the unit is vacated, the rent can revert to market. So you get what's called vacancy decontrol. So if you can encourage the tenants to leave, now you've got a vacant unit, you can put the rent up whatever you want. So the last couple of years, we've seen rents, Montreal, Ottawa, going up 5, 6, 7%. Even though there's a rent guideline that said the rent can only go up 2% a year, if it's going up by 8% a year, as it did last year in Ottawa, a bunch of units have got to be going up 20 so that the weighted average comes back down to 8. So you see these sort of strategies around rent evictions. So basically come in and say, we just bought this building, we're going to renovate, so we want you to leave, they evict you. Or they don't evict you, but they go in there and they start doing work and it's really disruptive and you just choose to leave because you can't stand living there anymore. So they employ these various strategies to encourage folks to leave, and then they can bring the rents to a higher level and increase their yield. So we've seen in the, the last two census, so 2011, 2016, if you look at the number of units in the country with rents below $750 a month, which would be affordable at 30% to someone with an income below $30,000, we lost 322,000 units in that 5 years. So 80,000 units a year were lost from the existing stock. Now, they weren't lost in absolute terms. Some of them were, probably about a third of them did actually disappear completely because they were knocked down for redevelopment. But the other two thirds were simply properties that capital funds and REITs had purchased, and the rents had moved above the 750. So the unit actually exists, but it no longer existed at an affordable rent. And that really undermines the stock and the supply of the lower rent units. And there's a lot of low income folks looking for those units. So there's quite a lot of demand, but there's very little supply. And folks that do find a lower rent unit will tend to try to stay there as long as they can, because they can't find anything else they can afford.
I'd be interested in hearing about that figure you used about just kind of like as a baseline indicator of what was it, $750 a month or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it was an arbitrary choice of a number just because the way the census records rents, $750 was the cutoff. It's $500, $750, $750, $1,000 kind of stuff. And, $30,000 is sort of the upper bound of a low income kind of thing. So you're trying to sort of capture that part of the market.
Right. Okay, and so I guess 95% of the housing stock in Canada roughly is privately owned. Yes. So if we're looking for solutions, is the idea to, do we need to shift to a different proportion? Do we need more of this kind of, I guess, like social housing too, to define that, it's a government subsidy that can be paid to private or to not-for-profit entities?
Yeah, there are various mechanisms. I mean, the main form of social housing would be a property that's built by and owned by a public agency. So it could be the Office of Housing in Montreal and whatever, public offices you have around the country, or by a non-profit housing corporation or a cooperative would own and operate the units. And they generally receive subsidy, and they generally set rents on an administrative basis, based on percentage of income, 30% of income, that kind of thing, as opposed to the rents being set in the marketplace. Now, in the private sector, you can also have private landlords who can participate in government-funded subsidy programs called rent supplements, where they'll contract with the government to say, look, I'll give you 20 units and we'll agree on what the rents are going to be. And, the rent might be, we agree that it's 800, but the people living there can only afford to pay 500. So you'll provide a subsidy to cover the difference, kind of thing. So we have a bit of both, more of the actual owned stock, less of the rent supplement type stock, but that has been at different times, depending on market cycles. When vacancy rates are very low, landlords are quite happy to go out on the private market and find tenants. When vacancy rates are high, it's an easy game for them to basically just secure an agreement for 20 units and make sure they're full, and they get the government kind of paying the rent. So we have a bit of a mix of both, but say more on the supply side. And I say, in terms of your question, given that the number you know, 5% of our stock is in the non-market, you know, relatively affordable sector. There are affordable units in the private sector as well, but that's the stuff we know we can preserve the low rents. Give or take 13 to 15% over the last 15, 20 years of households are deemed to be in core housing need. So they need government help to get their housing. So we've got 5% of social housing and we got another 15% that need it. We need to grow that stock by you know, three times as much, right? Up to 20%. So how do we get a larger nonprofit sector, non-market sector? We can build more social housing. It's very expensive to build and the subsidies associated with that make it very, very difficult to get to that quantum. We can enable nonprofits, and I think Montreal is one city that does this much better than most cities, to help the nonprofits purchase some of those buildings. So instead of the REITs buying them and taking the rents up market, a nonprofit buys them and keeps the rents moderate. Again, you know, Montreal has passed a bylaw last year on a right of first refusal to when a building is being transacted, that they can basically step in and say to the vendor, under this bylaw, we have the right to basically pay you the same thing this other guy offered you, and we're going to keep the units in the non-market sector. The constraint with that, of course, is that, you know, the city only has a limited budget to do that, and they can only buy a few buildings. They can't buy, you know, there's a portfolio of 2,200 units sold to a REIT in Montreal last month. And I talked to the folks in the city and said, well, how did that, you know, fall between the cracks, given your bylaw? And it turned out that, I mean, it's only the city of Montreal that has the bylaw. So all but one of the properties were in the other boroughs. So their bylaw didn't apply. And the one, they do designate specific neighborhoods where there tends to be a high proportion of rental at moderate rents. And the building that was purchased just didn't happen to be in one of those neighborhoods. So it sort of fell between the cracks. So there have been attempts to try to control and stop this predatory purchasing, for lack of a better term, but they are constrained by the fiscal resources of the municipality to do that.
Okay, so I mean that seems like then that would be a place where, you know, you need either provincial or maybe federal government to step in and try to provide funds. And I know I haven't read the policy, but I just read that, you know, there is this kind of national housing strategy that was, I guess, introduced in what,
2017?
Okay. I don't know. Do you want to just explain maybe briefly what that is and if it's effective, what its shortcomings are?
I mean, basically the National Housing Strategy, I mean, it really was the culmination of over two decades of lobbying and advocacy from the affordable housing sector. And to some extent, I mean, they were sort of asking for the wrong thing. Careful what you ask for. The federal government got out of funding social housing in the mid-1990s. So this advocacy started up and they used the mantra, we're the only OECD country without a National Housing Strategy. We need one to get investment for this very necessary, you know, public service. Called affordable housing. And I said to a bunch of my clients in the sector, I said, well, what we don't actually want a strategy. What we actually want is significant funding. You might get a strategy with no money and you're no better off. So we got a strategy. It was a very much a government relations, public relations kind of exercise by government, a lot of rah-rah hoopla around it. You know, the first ever national housing strategy, the largest ever funding by a government, federal government, towards the housing sector. Marginally true, only because they actually cast it as a 10-year funding plan, and most budget decisions are 5-year cycles. So it's, you're twice as long, it's easy to be the biggest. Inflation adjusted terms, it's not actually any bigger than stuff we had back in the 70s and 80s. So there was a lot of hyperbole in the announcements around it. And it tries to do a number of things. There are the two primary objectives of the National Housing Strategy are to reduce housing need, rental housing need by 50% over 10 years, and to reduce homelessness, chronic homelessness by 50% over 10 years. And then they announced $40 billion over 10 years to do that. And there are a bunch of mechanisms in there. Because we have built up this social housing stock, this 5%, which is about 600,000 units over the last, since pretty well the mid-1960s, that's now getting quite old. And we need to basically update it and renew it and modernize it, in some cases intensify and redevelop some of those sites. So there's a bundle of funding that's associated with preserving and improving the existing legacy social housing stock. There's a piece around adding new affordable units, so supporting supply and new construction of affordable units. Although the structure of that subsidy is quite shallow, so it's not like the old days where you could get really deep RGI. It's sort of moderate rent level type affordability. And then the there's another piece that recognizes the fact that people with low income, the reason they're paying more than 30, 40, 50% of their income for rent is because they have low income. And so, you know, rather than building, you know, building a house and giving them a house for life, just giving them $300 or $400 a month, you can reduce that from 50% down to 30%, and you can solve their affordability problems. So there's a piece called the Canada Housing Benefit, which is supposed to assist 300,000 households by providing them monthly payments to help them pay their rent. Although the funding in the national strategy isn't really consistent with that quantum of with that goal of 300,000. And then the fourth piece around ending homelessness is a bunch of funding to help communities replan their systems planning around shelters and emergency shelters to try to create more prevention and diversion programs, and then to basically through housing first programs find housing for folks who are living in the shelter and get them housed, stably housed with wraparound supports and those types of things. Again, a very good goal and good strategy, but the funding level is not really sufficient to really fully support it. So those are the key elements of the national strategy.
Yeah, isn't the first place to look rent control, or am I missing something?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if your sole objective is to make existing housing more affordable for existing residents, rent controls are quite an effective mechanism. The problem is that as our population grows and we need to build more housing, when you suppress the revenue that you can generate from an asset, you dissuade the potential investors in those assets from investing it. Capital will flow to the places where it can, you know, have its biggest return, right? So the argument that's always been made by the industry is that rent controls are a very serious deterrent that stop rent construction. And if we don't build any rental housing, vacancy rates will get really low and rents will go up, and it's a counteractive or a counterintuitive kind of policy. And I think to some extent they are right. I mean, the you know, we did see from the mid 1990s until about 2015, you know, nationally, our home ownership rate's 68%. So give or take, one third of us are renters. If we look at national housing starts for since the 1970s, for the 20 years, sort of 1995, 2015, less than 10% of new housing was rental. And so we really don't, you know, we had this undersupply of rental housing kind of going on. And most of the development industry, they were, you know, they're going to build multi-res buildings, but they'd rather build them as condo because it's less regulated and they can basically sell it right away. And there are a whole bunch of other dynamics. The trouble is that there are multiple factors that influence the motivation to build and own rental. Rent control is one, tax policy is another, the cost of capital is another. And people tend to bundle one thing up, you know, if they've got a particular bias. So the opponents of rent control would point to rent control and say, well, because you've got rent controls, we're not building rental. Well, rent regulation in this country didn't really change in that 20 years from 1995 to 2015. And then in 2015, all of a sudden, developers started building rental housing. And we went from less than 20,000 units a year to over 60,000 units last year. So we've tripled the volume of rent construction. It's not because we went out and reduced rent regulation and made it easier. So it does show that there are other factors that were actually more important than rent controls. But it is quite a strong political argument. I think in Quebec, it's sold better because you have a much stronger renter culture in Quebec, and the voters are, you know, more, there are more renters voting than there are owners. The balance of power in Quebec and Montreal in particular, I think until the last census, Montreal was still a majority renters. And you've got quite strong renter associations, whereas in the rest of Canada, our community associations tend to be owner dominated. So it's a different, there's a very, you know, as McLennan and Stewart said 40 years ago, it's two solitudes, very, very different context in terms of Quebec versus the rest of the country and sort of their acceptance and willingness to go with rent controls. So it's quite a controversial policy.
No, I don't know much about economics and don't understand it very well, but I have, I was looking at an Economics for Dummies PDF, and the thing I found interesting about, you know, they make a special point in my Economics for Dummies textbook of railing against rent control and for the reasons you described. But what I find interesting is that, you know, that the housing situation seems as bad, or the rental situation seems as bad or worse in innumerable cities in North America that don't have any form of rent control. So
we have this great natural experiment in Canada called Quebec and Alberta. Alberta has no rent controls and has all the same affordability issues and rising rents and all those types of things and lack of rental construction. And Quebec, which has the strongest rent controls in the country, has the highest per capita and absolute number of rental construction units in the country. So that kind of does fly in the face of these theoretical arguments that you'll dissuade rental development.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so one is that another thing that gets press is the role of like Airbnb eating up rental stock. How much of a factor is that?
I think it's quite significant. You actually have one of the leading academics in the country, David Walsh. Come on, exactly how to pronounce his last name, David W. something, is Ed McGill. And he's done a very extensive research on the extent of the what's called short-term rentals like Airbnb across the country and what proportion of the market they are and what effects they have. It is quite substantial, particularly in the larger cities and particularly in the tourist type cities. What we've seen in the last couple of years, as we've realized, the extent to which this is really removing stock that could be in the long-term rental market, and hence reducing vacancy rates and putting pressure on rents. So cities like Toronto, Vancouver, Ottawa last year have now passed bylaws limiting short-term rentals to properties the traditional type of B&B where you live in the house and you rent out a couple of rooms on a nightly basis, but you can no longer buy a condo and operate an Airbnb out of a condo in Toronto, Vancouver, and Ottawa. And so that has, I think in Ottawa, I think the estimates are something like 10 or 12,000 units in the downtown core have gone back into the long-term rental market as a result of that. So it has been a very significant factor and impact on tightening rental markets, and unraveling it by regulating against it has actually been quite effective.
Okay, well, that's a great segue into, I guess, what would be my final question, because it's sort of it's a good practical example of where, a fairly straightforward policy change seems to make a big difference. So in your view, if there's a single sort of legislative move that you would make to try to improve the situation, especially for low-income renters, maybe in Canada in general, but perhaps, provincially, what would you suggest?
I have long been of the view that rent controls are, for the reasons we discussed, not a particularly effective mechanism. But because the problem has become so acute in the face of this new phenomenon of financialization, which is driven by the fact that rental assets are now perceived as a very desirable asset class, and you've got too much money chasing after them with very, very serious negative effects on low-income renters. But I think there is sort of a market failure externalities argument that suggests maybe we need to moderate this instead of, there are two aspects of rent control, controlling the rents for institute tenants and controlling the rents on vacancies. Perhaps we need to step back from vacancy decontrol, because that's what's creating the extra cream that makes these assets much more attractive for investors. If we reduce their attractiveness by taking away the vacancy decontrol piece, so rents could still go up, but in a controlled, regulated kind of sense, the inflation plus a little bit kind of thing, like we do for sitting tenants. That may take some of the pressure off the rental market and reduce that the degree to which financialization is just scooping up these units and taking the rents up market. It would be a controversial move. I don't know which governments would be prepared to do it, and it would have to be done at the provincial level as opposed to the federal level. But it seems to me, in terms of potential effectiveness of addressing this, the squeeze that we're seeing at the bottom end of the rental market, it's probably the one that could bear the most fruit.
Great. I just made me think of these, just a requirement to build, say, like X number of social housing units when you have a new build. Is that like an attractive?
Well, again, Montreal is the most aggressive in the country on doing that. I mean, you have an inclusionary zoning policy that was notionally voluntary until last year when you made it mandatory. But even, the voluntary version of it was such because you have strong renter associations. The one in a development application in Montreal was seeking approval for a condo. These renter associations would basically, force the developer to adhere to the 20% inclusionary requirement. I think, what tends to happen is, land has no inherent value until the municipality approves a particular use on it. So it's the public decision-making process that actually creates value in land. and property. And therefore, if it's a public decision, then increasing the density from 10 units to 40 units creates a significant uplift and benefit for a developer, all entirely based on a public decision.
For those who are concerned about, you know, housing justice or affordable housing more broadly, you know, what should they do?
Well, it's you know, lobbying and advocacy, one voice at a time, you know.
Good afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.